Hi, I'm Sally Hughes and this is the return of Beyond the Bathroom, where each week I find out how my guests feel about their own appearance. But today is a break from the usual format to make it all about you. One of the great things about having Skin and Me as our series sponsor is that we have access to their expert dermatology team. And so I wanted to give you access to their advice and wisdom by inviting you to submit your skin-related questions. You've been emailing in, and today, in this special episode of Beyond the Bathroom, I'm putting your questions to my guests. And they are Dr. Jason Thompson. We've met Dr. Jason before, as we've done Instagram Lives together in the last series. He's the head of medical at Skin and Me. He's won numerous prizes for his academic research and papers in the field of dermatology, and he has a huge personal passion for managing skin conditions like acne and skin cancers in both adults and children. Today he's brought with him a colleague we haven't met before. I'm really excited to welcome Dr. Bebe Duharpa. She is another expert dermatologist who is newer to Skin and Me. Again, she's an acclaimed and published dermatologist, this time with a particular interest in cosmetic dermatology and the health of follicles and pores. But before that, a massive thank you to our wonderful series sponsor, Skin and Me. Skin and Me is your most accessible, fast track to simplified skincare, offering powerful active ingredients in formulations you can't buy on the high street. Skin and Me can create a treatment for your specific skin concerns, tailored to you by experts. Whether you want to target adult acne, pigmentation, melasma, rosacea, or skin aging, this is powerful, personalized skincare that truly works. As someone who has used Skin and Me for years, I can honestly say I wouldn't go without it. Now, on to today's episode of Beyond the Bathroom. Welcome.
Thank you so much for having us.
Thanks for coming. I'm so excited about this. We have so many questions and they're really, really diverse. So I think we should just get cracking. I have names for some of them. Some of them didn't leave their names. So where you've left a name, I will mention you. Where you haven't, you'll obviously remain anonymous. Shall we get cracking?
Yes.
So Jill asks, how can doctors prescribe to patients they have never met? Do they just prescribe lower concentrations? I've used Skin and Me for over a year. It's the only cream in my life where I could tell made a difference. But my question is, how does it work? Not does it work? So I think what Jill's saying there is, if you can't see someone, how can you decide what's best for them? Even though clearly in this case, it has worked for her.
Yeah, I think there's two things to unpick in that question from Jill. The first part is really what's been happening in medicine for decades. Since the 90s, there's been this concept of telemedicine, which is doing medicine remotely. And dermatology lends itself really well to telemedicine, purely because it's the most visual of like all specialties. So we've been doing it for a long time, and it's been shown to be as effective as seeing somebody face to face for certain conditions. And it's mainly the visual things, so like facial skin conditions like acne, rosacea, melasma. They've all been shown that you can diagnose them with photographs remotely and not actually ever physically meet the patient. So I think it's been proven to be safe and effective, and it's been mainstream for quite a long time now. Since the COVID pandemic, I think it's really kind of accelerated the use of teledermatology, and it's a really good way to make it accessible without having to actually physically go and see a dermatologist. So I think that's the key part to number one. And then the second part is, so there was a question around the strengths and the prescribing.
Yeah, so she's saying, if you can't see, do you sort of minimize risk? Do you take a low risk decision to prescribe low concentrations?
So I would say no. Generally, if you're able to diagnose a condition like acne, you're then going to be able to prescribe what you think is the most effective treatment for that patient. There's no real need to kind of de-risk by giving something a different strength or a different ingredient because you're too worried about giving something too strong. I think the one caveat to that is oral medications. So things like isotretinoin can be a bit more tricky to prescribe when you're doing it remotely because you have to do quite a lot of counselling and give a lot of information. And it's really important that you make sure that your patient's able to understand all that. So I think that may be where you choose what you're prescribing slightly differently. But generally, when you're giving topical treatments, so like the creams with different ingredients in them, you would go for what you think is the most suitable for your patient, and you wouldn't generally kind of de-risk it by giving them a lower strength. The reason we, or as dermatologists, would choose different strengths for different people is purely because of the kind of the personalization of medicine that we want to achieve. So some people might have never had a retinoid before or be more sensitive, kind of have more sensitive skin. And it's those types of kind of scenarios that you might want to kind of adapt your strengths and things like that.
Yeah, I always say to people that, you know, skin is very helpful, isn't it? It's the only major organ you have that tells you how it's doing by looking at it. You know, we're none the wiser about all the things inside our body very often, but skin's pretty good at letting you know what's going on.
And sometimes it lets you know what's going on inside in your other organs,
right,
as well.
Right.
So, you know, it can tell the story of your general health sometimes too.
Yeah, absolutely. Karen's asking, hi Sally, is there anything that will get rid of white scarring left from a red spot squeeze? I think that must be such a common issue. So many people meddle with spots and are left with pigmentation or various marks on their face. What would you recommend there?
So I think it depends on the depth of the scar. So more superficial scars where it's mostly discoloration, that can definitely be improved with skincare, and things such as tretinoin can certainly help with scarring and pigmentary changes. If it's a deep scar, you know, because obviously acne spots can, you know, they do originate quite deeply within the skin, and if the scar is actually quite a deep scar, then topical treatments are sort of less effective. So it really depends on what the actual situation is. I think the key is you can actually make the scarring worse when you pick your spots. I think everybody sort of knows that, but you know, the reason for that is because the outer layer of your skin, your epidermis and your dermis, are separated, and they're meant to be separated. And when you start squeezing and picking, what happens is keratin in your epidermis goes deeper into your skin and actually generates more inflammation. And also just the picking process itself will attract more inflammatory cells. So all of these things are reasons why, you know, picking your skin in the first place is probably the number one thing. Depending on the depth of the scarring, it's, you know, different treatments might be better.
So after the horse has bolted, there are a variety of treatments you can look at.
Yeah.
Tretinoin being one of them. What other kinds of things might you recommend to a patient who came to you?
Things that speed up your cell turnover can obviously yield fresh new skin cells, which, you know, might match the surrounding skin better. So anything that helps with that, such as glycolic acid and your retinoids, and things that help specifically with pigmentary changes. But usually things like azelaic acid, you're talking more about darker spots as opposed to lighter spots. So I do wonder with her specific situation, it might be useful to have a clinical assessment, because usually you would end up with a darker spot with an acne spot, in my experience.
Just add that, so that white scarring, I think just taking a step back, often people will refer to any discoloration on their skin after acne lesions as scarring. It's actually a very different process. So the way I kind of explain to my patients is, if you can rub your finger over that area and it's flat and you can't feel any change to the actual structure of the skin, then it's probably not scarring. It's actually probably just hypopigmentation, so lightening of the skin. And you can also get post-inflammatory hyperpigmentation, where you get increased melanin and darkening of the skin. And how you treat the kind of discoloration of the skin is actually quite different and a lot easier than actually treating scarring of the skin. So scarring is when you get an actual structural change, and it can be quite tricky to treat scarring, definitely with skincare. And often, as Bebe said, you end up having to use a lot more kind of invasive treatments like lasers and microneedling. Things like that are actually going deeper into the skin where the dermis is. So I think the first thing is, trying to work out, what are we talking about here? Is it scarring? Is it discoloration? And then if you think it is just discoloration, the key thing, and for anything to do with any pigmentation or discoloration, is sunscreen. Scarring can be affected by sun exposure as well, but protecting your skin from ultraviolet light is a key kind of strategy to stop it happening in the first place. And also treating the underlying acne, I think that's really important as well. So I think if you came to see us in a clinic or at Skin and Me, if we see active acne, the first thing we'll do, and we'll explain this to the patient, is we have to switch off that acne process first. Let things settle down, reassess, and then at that stage we can work out, is this scarring, is this discoloration or pigmentation issues, and then kind of make a strategy at that point. But those prevention measures are really important.
Yes, it's putting the fire out, isn't it?
Absolutely.
Before you start kind of the cleanup operation.
How often do you think you see hypopigmentation versus hyper? I just thought that was an interesting point that you made.
Well, it'd be great actually if you could explain in layperson's terms the difference between the two for anyone at home listening who doesn't know.
So hypo means less pigment and hyper means more pigment. And usually after any inflammatory process, we would see some sort of change in pigmentation in the skin. So for example, if you cut your skin and the like a little scab formed and then that healed and came off, you would see a discolored line on your skin, for example. And in my skin tone, for me, that would usually end up with a darker mark than the surrounding skin. So that would be hyperpigmentation. And that's what I would experience personally after having a spot. So I just thought it was interesting that this person has had a hypopigmented area, or potentially it could be a deeper scar. It's not clear from the question.
Yeah, I agree. I think most of the time it's hyperpigmentation.
Yeah.
And it's very dependent on your skin tone as well. With darker skin tones, more likely to get hyperpigmentation.
Yeah.
And maybe the white, you are more likely to see white if you've got a scarring process, actually.
So totally.
Maybe this is giving us more of a hint.
And sometimes people will end up with a little myelia sometimes as well.
Yes.
And I wonder whether actually that's what they're observing rather than a scar or a dispigmented area. So that's why I think it's always really useful to see a clinician, because a lot of the time I think people are self-diagnosing at home and it might not always be accurate, because it does take quite a lot of skill and practice to make the right judgment and then pick the product that works.
Absolutely. Let's pause this conversation briefly to thank our brilliant series sponsor, Skin and Me, whose dermatologists are answering your skincare questions, and I hope you're finding it as interesting as I am. Skin and Me can help everyone achieve their best skin. Whether you want to target fine lines and wrinkles, skin texture and pores, adult acne, pigmentation, melasma, rosacea, or you just want a healthy skin glow, Skin and Me has a solution for you or a loved one. This is powerful, personalized skincare designed by experts with formulations you won't find on the high street, delivered directly to your door. Every single consultation and photo set you submit is personally reviewed by an expert dermatology clinician. Your formulation is then made to order and evolves each month as your skincare journey progresses. Plus, you'll have regular check-ins with the dermatology team to monitor your progress, and you'll have access to expert advice whenever you need it. Try your first month of personalized treatment from Skin and Me for $4.99 instead of the usual $24.99. Just visit skinandme.com and use the code SALLYANDME to get started. So we don't have a name for this one, but this one does come up a lot. My friend has a very dry, very itchy skin around her eyes. Besides making an appointment with a dermatologist, what might help? So dryness, itchiness around the eyes. She doesn't say if there are lumps and bumps, just really dry, itchy skin around the eyes.
This can be a really common issue for people who have eczema prone skin. I think the first thing that I would counsel to people with this sort of predilection, try and identify if there's any triggers or anything that you're doing that is making this happen. So a lot of people might habitually rub their eyes or be using products that might be irritating the skin around their eyes. So first of all, remove things that may be making things worse. I would definitely, for anyone who has skin that can feel itchy, just use products that are as minimalist and simple as possible, because there are often things in products that can be irritating to people's skin, especially if they are eczema prone or dry skin prone. For example, things that, you know, are excessively fragranced or, you know, contain preservatives sometimes can be an issue. I mean, it really depends on the product a lot of the time. So using really simple products, using treatments to help dampen down the inflammation as well can be really important. So if I saw someone like that in clinic, I would first of all try and calm that inflammation down with prescription products and then introduce skincare that might help me sort of prevent it from reoccurring again. So that would be my approach.
I would add, as a layperson, not giving any medical advice whatsoever here, but having met so many women and talked to them about their skin, pens with a brush attached cause this so often. Wash the concealer brush at the end. So you have these clicky pens that have a brush attached. And the problem is that people don't wash them the way they do a normal makeup brush. And so they get stinky and bacteria laden. And I see so many women with kind of crusty contact dermatitis type eyes that they've got from one of those pens. You must wash the nib of those pens.
Yeah.
it more often than you replace the pen itself. That comes up all the time. Kind of dirty applicators around the eyes seem to cause all sorts of problems.
That's fascinating.
It's a very sensitive area. It's the thinnest skin on your face.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
So it is much more prone to dryness, sensitivity, irritation. So I completely agree with everything Bebe is saying. And really, I would, if you came to see us in clinic with big, dry, inflamed eye skin, you'd just strip everything right back with that skincare routine. So for a really gentle cleanser that's hydrating, just have a moisturiser, a good moisturiser that's got humectants, emollients, kind of the thicker the better, usually when your skin barrier sounds this disrupted, and avoiding all those potentially irritating ingredients. And that goes for active ingredients. So stop retinoids, stop vitamin C, stop anything that's active, like the acids, but also really strip back anything with fragrance, with potentially kind of irritant ingredients. So it's hard to sometimes read an inky list if you're not an expert, but there are certain things like alcohol, denatured alcohol, that you'll find in a lot of sunscreens. They can be quite irritant. So it's good to just kind of avoid anything that could be triggering it. Sunscreen itself, the filters in sunscreens can sometimes be irritant. So it might be worth switching your sunscreen to a mineral sunscreen because they're generally a bit better tolerated. But it's almost like a bit of detective work here because you're trying to work out kind of what is the product or the ingredient in the product that's causing this. If we think it's an irritant or an allergic contact dermatitis. So it can be quite tricky, and that's why it's best just to kind of strip it right back to basics and potentially kind of add things back in if you do manage to get on top of it.
Essentially, we're going back to that old thing of bland and moist.
Super
bland and moist until things calm down, and then reintroducing things to try and find out.
I think getting the barrier as healthy as possible. Because once the barrier is healthy, you can go back to using more exciting products and, you know, using more makeup and things like that more comfortably, going back to basics first.
I would say, actually, although this person said dermatologist aside, I think if you do these kind of general measures and you're still not seeing an improvement, I think it is important because there might be an allergic component to this where we can go and do patch testing and actually get a diagnosis. So I think it often will come down to what is the diagnosis, and then you can really get the
sometimes it's allergens in the air, especially for periocular issues. So that's why we would do things like patch testing.
Birch tree pollen, usually kind of the April, beginning of summer, you'll see loads of people with a dermatitis around their eye, and it's because they're actually allergic to the birch tree. So again, timing of the year as well can have a big play.
And we
this.
Know with these sorts of allergies from kind of hay fever rates and so on, that you can just develop them out of the blue, having been completely fine for years on end. Right?
Yeah. And preservatives that you get in things like paint, you know, when you're painting your walls, suddenly people get a reaction around their eyes. You know, these things can happen. So it's sometimes you do need a doctor to help you do the detective work.
Yes, I know somebody who had irritated eyes, and it turned out she was always touching them with gel polish that she was allergic to. She was touching her eyes. It can be all manner of things, can't it? And we can develop these things from nowhere. Oh, such a common question, and one I always quite enjoy because it's relatively fixable. From Nancy, best solution for keratosis pilaris.
So this is a really common skin condition.
So common.
So we get these little bumps under the surface of the skin, usually upper arms, can be on the legs, buttocks. In kids, you often see it on the face as well, on the cheeks. And there's a few strategies for this. I think the first thing to say is it's not harmful. It's not, you're not going to catch it from somebody. Generally doesn't have any kind of symptoms from it. It just looks unsightly. And there's no real cure for it. As you get older, it tends to disappear. So the first kind of most basic approach is moisturizer. It's usually dry, and just moisturizing the skin can be enough to just stop it from appearing. And then if you want to be a bit more proactive, you can use things like exfoliants, chemical exfoliants that can actually break down the keratin. So what's actually happening in keratosis pilaris is you're getting these little plugs of keratin in the hair follicle. So ingredients that can actually dissolve that keratin or dissolve the bonds between the keratin are usually quite helpful. So salicylic acid, lactic acid, urea is another good one. Yeah. And the nice thing is you can usually find these in combination with an emollient cream anyway. So there's quite a few products out there where you can get a nice moisturizer with the added benefit of an exfoliant. And usually that can have a good response if you use those things regularly. And there's probably some other kind of general skincare measures as well that you can do.
Like, and it's mostly genetic, actually. So often when you speak to people who have this, they'll mention that a relative of theirs has the same problem as well. And you can't really totally prevent it, but you can certainly improve the appearance through things like moisturising and exfoliating. So things which combine stuff like combined urea and lactic acid, I think, probably are the best options.
Yeah, agreed. I think also just in the shower, don't have a hot shower. That often can just make your skin a bit drier. Avoid soaps. Sometimes soaps can dry out the skin as well, kind of more than you need, and you a soap substitute, or just even taking your emollient into the shower. Those are other kind of measures that you can do just to help minimize that dryness that usually makes it look more obvious.
Yes, I have it. I've had it my whole life, and huge resounding seconding on lactic acid. It works brilliantly. I would not use it on a night out or a sex night, I have to say, because it stinks. But if you use it on a night where you're not doing anything except watching Netflix and drinking tea, then it works brilliantly. Catherine would like to know, do you have any breaks when using Skin and Me? So I would like to add to this question, say this question comes up a lot. So I'm a Skin and Me user, have been for years. People ask me a lot, do you stop in the summer? Do you stop on the weekends? Do you do it every other day? And so I think this is a really useful one to answer in full. It's the sort of language that people are used to reading about retinoids generally, right? So it would be a good opportunity to talk about the differences.
Retinoids are safe long term, and there's good data to show that the longer you use them, the more benefits you're actually going to see in your skin. And there's been studies done up to 5 years using retinoids, mm-hmm. like tretinoin, and they're very safe long term. So there's no real need, if your skin's tolerating the treatment well and you're seeing good improvements, there's no real need to stop it. And I know there's quite a lot of myths out there that you're kind of, you increase the skin cell turnover too much, you've got like a finite number of skin cycles your skin mm-hmm. can go through. That's all rubbish. I think where you might need to stop it, and where we'd recommend stopping it, is if you're having any issues. So this is the time of year when people start getting a bit more sensitivity, a bit of increased dryness as we move into the colder months, and you might find that your skin isn't as is not able to tolerate a retinoid as well. So if you're finding that you're getting some irritation or increased sensitivity, then it is usually a good idea to stop or to reduce the strength of that retinoid and let your skin barrier strengthen and heal. So that's definitely one kind of example when you should stop.
And that's something you can facilitate, isn't it? Because you can go back to Skin and Me and say, do you know what, right now it's not quite right, and you can adjust.
Exactly. And I think what we're talking about at the beginning is like the skin tells you, it's telling you how it's feeling. And I think it's really important to kind of be in tune to your own skin. Yeah. You might not see anything, you might not see that initial redness, but you can tell there's an increase in sensitivity. And usually that's the first thing to pick up on and think, okay, either I need to switch my skincare and kind of introduce a more nourishing, like a thicker emollient or my moisturizer, or is it maybe time to reduce the strength of my retinoid or have a bit of a break? That's the advice we'd usually give.
I think one of the best things about Skin and Me is the daily doser, and there is such value in having a daily habit. Mm-hmm. It's just like brushing your teeth. Mm-hmm. You know, it's consistency is what wins in the long term with many things to do with the human body, actually. So it's like brushing your teeth, doing exercise. Consistency is what works. And, you know, the great thing about Skin and Me is that you can alter the ingredients that are going into your daily doser if you need to, or just slightly change things a little bit, but it still provides that consistency. And so I think I would argue that actually this is a great way to stay consistent, even if, you know, the seasons are changing and, you know, your skin is slightly changing with it.
Yeah, I mean, lots of people think that you have to stop using any retinoid in the summer, which seems to be something that's come from, you know, the internet over the years. People seem to think, well, in the summer, I mean, there might be lifestyle reasons, you might not want to if you're on holiday, but there is no reason to stop in the summer, right?
No, I think this stems from the knowledge. I mean, there's information out there such as, you know, retinol is can break down under UV light. Mm-hmm. So that's what I think people are thinking about, or that it can make your skin slightly more sensitive. But in reality, you can use a retinoid all year round, including in the summer. And, you know, there's definitely no issues with that at all. I think that sometimes people take one piece of information and then equate it to a behaviour that doesn't quite match what we know in more generally.
I have to say, anecdotally, I have only ever stopped when I've had COVID. So I've had COVID and my skin has just been so upset and itchy, and I don't have sensitive skin at all.
Yeah.
But each time I've had COVID, particularly on the first two occasions, so itchy, just really itchy, unhappy, unwell skin. And so I just stopped dead, flat the end of that, until I was much better, and then reintroduced it diluted by a bland face cream until I was happy again. And I think, you know, what you're saying is right. It's listening, isn't it? It's listening when your skin is going, not today, thank you. And you just have to kind of be in tune with it. And each time I've reintroduced it and been back to normal, but those are the only times I've stopped, because clearly when I have COVID, my skin does not enjoy any active ingredient, and that's the end of it, you know.
Yeah.
And it's about listening, isn't it?
Absolutely.
We don't have a name for this question, But the question is, what's the best treatment for stubborn sunspots? I've tried skin peels and several IPL sessions before. When she says skin peel, I don't know what that means. I don't know if that means a kind of over-the-counter remedy or whether it's a mechanical peel or a chemical. I don't know what that means. But let's start with the top of it. What's the best treatment for stubborn sunspots?
So when I saw this question, my first thought was, I'm not sure what she's talking about by a stubborn sunspot, because it could be so many different things.
Right.
And people use terms like that. And, you know, when we see patients in clinic, they say, I've had this sunspot for ages, and it could be so many different things. So I think from a clinician's perspective, you know, we'd have to know exactly what we were dealing with. So, you know, things that people often refer to as sunspots include, you know, dark freckles, solar lentigo, so like more dark patches of skin, seborrheic keratoses, which are these slightly lumpy, dark, crusty bits of skin, sometimes moles. So it could really vary depending on what it is. And the treatment that you offer obviously depends on what the actual spot is. So it really, really depends.
I would anticipate that question, based on the kinds of questions I get asked all the time.
Yeah.
I would guess that question relates to a sort of brown liver spot type of thing.
Yeah. Like a solar lentigo.
Like an age spot that you might have on your hands or something. That's what, let's assume that. And we know it's an absolute assumption because we don't have any more information.
Yeah.
But it's a common one. And I think the answer based on that would be valuable.
Solar lentigo, it's kind of in the name, what's causing it's UV light. So I always seem to go to prevention first and talk about sunscreen. But I think actually, if you're going to be treating a solar lentigo, there's no point in treating
it
unless you're actually you're being careful in the sun. So sun protection is really key for treating solar lentigos and to stop them getting darker and to stop you getting new ones. And it's really a way for your skin telling you that you've had a lot of chronic UV exposure over your life. So it is a kind of a warning sign. But like switching now to, horses bolted and we actually want to treat the lesion in front of us. There's a few things. Topicals, if you want to start with topicals. There's agents like hydroquinone, retinoids, so tretinoin. They've got good evidence for kind of reducing the pigmentation. And they can work by increasing the skin cell turnover in the case of tretinoin. And in the case of hydroquinone, what it's doing is it's inhibiting the formation of new melanin, the pigment in the skin, by inhibiting an enzyme called tyrosinase. But it also works on actually destroying some of the pigment there as well. It's got to be prescribed. You can't go and get this over the counter. And it's an ingredient that's very effective, but has to be kind of used just on the affected skin, otherwise you can get kind of bleaching. So something that's not for everybody, but it is a very effective treatment.
Topically, I think the options are quite limited really for a solar lentigo. You need something a bit more destructive. So cryotherapy, where liquid nitrogen treatment can be effective. Even a little bit of minor skin surgery can help. Mm-hmm. So we're looking at things which are able to really tackle what's going on inside the skin. And, the changes that are there are quite structural. So I think topical skincare, although it can be helpful, it might need something a bit more, which it sounds like this person has explored with the IPL, actually. But it may be that they need something like a laser that might be more effective.
Yeah, there's certainly. So IPL isn't technically a laser.
No.
It's light. It's using a light source.
Yeah.
But you can get different. There's loads. We could do a whole podcast on lasers and how you can use different lasers for different skin conditions. But there are ones that are more specific to the pigment in the skin that you can use to actually remove the sunspot.
Do Skin and Me take into account if you are using a retinoid currently? As a subscriber myself, I can say that I certainly was asked whether I currently used any kind of retinoid because I've been a retinol user for a long time, or had been. I was certainly asked to detail that, and that was taken into account, but interested in your thoughts on that.
Yeah, absolutely. So you're right, Sally. There's questions that will dig into exactly what you've been using on your skin in terms of retinoids, but also kind of prescription retinoids and non-prescription retinoids. And yeah, absolutely is taken into account. So if you're already used to a kind of strong retinoid and you come over to Skin and Me, they will absolutely be taking that into consideration and definitely trying to kind of match you to what you're on previously. That's generally how we'd practice that kind of as dermatologists anyway, because retinoids, when you're brand new to them, your skin's going through quite a big process. They call it retinization, where your skin's getting a lot of kind of changes that are happening because of that retinoid with the increased skin cell turnover. So if you're completely new, you will be more cautious, and you'll tell people to start lower strength or only a few times a week. But if somebody's established and doing well on a more potent retinoid, you don't want to lose all that kind of hard work they've done. So we'd absolutely be kind of taking that into consideration.
So it's absolutely not the case that everyone would start at the very low baseline, that people would start across the board at different levels.
Yeah.
Absolutely, yeah.
Should you use Skin and Me every night or alternate? We've touched on this a little bit. Baby, you talked about consistency and how important that is. What would you say about the whole idea of stage gating? Is it necessary with Skin and Me?
No. I don't think so.
Yeah. And I think, yeah, the goes back to the daily doser, and what we've done as dermatologists, we've designed the service to be used every night, and that's reflected in the treatments and what you actually get and the strengths and things like that. But there absolutely will be cases where somebody's just that extra bit sensitive and they're listening to their skin, they're not able to tolerate it every night. And absolutely in those cases, it's usually advisable to reduce that frequency. So there's a few different tactics. If somebody's skin's not quite tolerating it, it's increasing the amount of moisturizer you use. You can use the sandwich method. The dermatology team have a whole kind of different bunch of bits of advice that they'll recommend. But one of those bits of advice may be reducing the frequency whilst your skin's kind of getting used to that retinoid and that retinization phase. And usually the aim will be to, once their skin is tolerating it, to get them up to nightly, because you're getting all the benefits of the ingredients when you're using them nightly.
And this is a related question, I think, because some of the advice will be the same, I imagine. Can retinol, but let's just say retinoids as a category, can retinoids be applied all over the face, or do you need to avoid certain areas? So I'm somebody who uses it all over my face, but I would pop some moisturiser on my eyes before I cracked on. What are your thoughts on this?
I think you could use it all over your face. I think it depends entirely on how you tolerate it. So I don't think there's any rule against not using it around your eyes. I think if you are tolerating it, carry on. You know, some people might benefit from using some moisturizer to buffer the area first.
Yeah.
I think also the area around your mouth and your nose, you have to be a little bit careful about as well. Using actives, especially for the first time, in some people can trigger sensitivity. And what you do want to avoid is perioral dermatitis. And I'd say that would be one thing that I think if you were starting for the very first time, I'd be quite careful about, making sure you're sort of covering the eye area and just sort of around the nasal folds and around the lips.
Yes, anywhere where anything active gathers, right? Yeah. In little creases, yeah. And dips,
exactly,
and troughs,
yeah,
in the face.
It tends to move as well. So you may even avoid the eye area and you might find your eyes are still getting sensitive, mm-hmm, because when you put a cream with actives in it, it does tend to migrate. Mm-hmm. So that's why if you do have sensitive skin, definitely protect and buffer those sensitive eye, nose, mouth areas with a moisturiser before you put your treatment on.
Let's stick with perioral dermatitis because Paula is asking about it. What's your recommendation to lessen the redness of perioral dermatitis? So we talked there about buffering if you're using actives. I suppose what would be general best practice if suddenly you start developing perioral dermatitis? So common. Mm. Because there can be lots of different causes, right?
Yeah, I would stop the actives in, first. And, you know, you really want to minimise all skincare as much as you can. So go really, really, really basic. And depending on the severity, you might need a separate treatment just to get the perioral dermatitis under control as well. But it depends on how severe it is. So for milder cases, some topical treatment might be enough to get it under control. If it's very severe, it's going on for a long time, then sometimes we even recommend tablets to help get it under control.
Yeah, avoiding the trigger is key, really.
Yeah.
And it could be actives in skincare, but often it's steroids, topical steroids that people are using for conditions like eczema. Mm-hmm. They're probably the most kind of common trigger. Absolutely, you just need to stop that first and foremost and then really strip back your skincare routine.
I would also suggest thinking about whether you've changed your toothpaste recently.
Yeah.
Because
yeah.
The only time in my life I've ever had perioral dermatitis, I'd recently changed toothpaste. It's always worth swapping that out.
Absolutely.
Really good point.
Any tips for keeping SPF on my rosacea reddened face in melty heat, please? So I think what this listener is saying is that she has rosacea, she has a red face, she's diligent about her SPF, but in this heat, how does she keep it on her skin? Can be hard when rosacea offers texture as well to hang on to things when you've got an uneven texture.
Yeah, I think it really depends on the sunscreen. I think some products have so much more grip in them than others, and some products feel very slippery. So I would just pick an SPF which has a real grippy sense. So for example, the Eevee sunscreen, I don't know if you've ever tried that. That feels like it really grips to your skin, and I don't think that would feel like it would slide off. Some mineral sunscreens, because they have that kind of chalky, astringent texture to them, can also feel like they stay put a bit more as well and might not migrate so much. So I think picking the right sunscreen is key.
There's just so many textures and formats of sunscreen. And generally, if it sounds like it's kind of all falling off their face and they're really hot and it feels quite occlusive one that you've been using, switch it to, there's some really beautifully light texture sunscreens out there. Go to switch to a light texture sunscreen. And maybe, as you're saying, maybe more a kind of mattifying one.
Totally.
A lot of nice mattifying. Mm. There seems to be some that mattify and some act as primers, and then there's some that are very dewy and make your skin look quite oily. So I think it really comes down to your skin type and preference. But for this question, I would say switch it to a nice light one. The redness, maybe you can actually get some sunscreens now that have some green pigment actually kind of mask that redness that you get with rosacea. So maybe that's an idea as well. Or sometimes you can get some nice sunscreens with antioxidants that can actually kind of work to reduce that redness.
I mean, you can even get makeup setting sprays with SPF in them now. I wouldn't use them as my main SPF, but a good top up if you want to use those that kind of give grip to your makeup and your skincare underneath. You can even get them without alcohol now. There are all sorts of different ones on the market. Don't know who's asking this, but this does come up a lot. Should I still use vitamin C in the winter? From my cold, dead hands, are you taking my vitamin C in the winter? I want it more than ever. I need the glow. What do you guys think?
I don't see why you would stop in the winter. I think maybe some people are, you know, they know that vitamin C is part of sun protection. Mm-hmm. So they're thinking, oh, it's winter time. Mm-hmm. I should stop. But vitamin C is not just part of UV protection. It's an antioxidant. We're exposed to lots of oxidative stress in general in our daily lives, even when there isn't sun. So pollution, for example, is a contributor to oxidative stress that manifests in our skin. So I would use vitamin C all year round just to minimize that oxidative stress in the skin and reduce the free radical damage. So absolutely no reason to stop.
Yeah, I'm not sure why this person would like to stop, or there's a suggestion that you should stop. Vitamin C is a real multitasker. It's good for boosting collagen, for anti-aging effects, for brightening the skin and pigmentation. So it's a real great ingredient to incorporate into usually a morning skincare routine, so you get all those antioxidant benefits. The only thing I could think was maybe during the winter months, our skin's a bit more irritant and they're finding that their vitamin C serum is maybe too irritant. And if that's the case, then there's so many vitamin C's out there. I know they're not all created equally, but you might not want to have the strongest ascorbic acid at 15%, which can be quite acidic and quite stripping on the skin. Switch it up and go for maybe a lower strength in a formula that's a bit more hydrating if you're finding that your vitamin C is a bit too drying for the winter months.
On that subject, I would like to ask you my own question. I always ask dermatologists this. Do you take supplements? Do you ingest supplements for your skin?
I don't. And I've been looking closely at the evidence for things like collagen supplementation.
Me too.
And there's papers coming out, there's reviews that are summarizing all these papers, but the studies just aren't good enough at this point in time for me to kind of, with my dermatologist hat on, actually kind of advocate it. But there are other supplements. Vitamin D is probably the only one I think we should all be taking. And we are recommended during the winter months in the UK for everyone to be on vitamin D, just because we don't get enough of it during the winter months. So that's probably, and that has good effects, important effects for the skin and internally for lots of different organs. So that's probably the only supplement I would recommend at this stage.
I think collagen is quite expensive. That would be my main. I don't think there's any harm in taking collagen. And I think the evidence is moderate. And I think if you really want to optimize and you love supplements and you want to try it, I think people are free to try it. I don't think it's, I think that there is enough evidence to say, okay, if you really fancy it, give it a go. But I think there are lower hanging fruits in terms of optimizing skin health and in terms of daily habits that we could incorporate. So I would, you know, personally say, you know, eat a healthy, balanced diet above taking a collagen supplement. And most of us probably aren't eating the most, you know, healthy, balanced diet. And I think often people are looking at supplements because they see it as a shortcut.
Yes.
And that I don't think that's a good idea. Like looking for the shortcuts to health don't generally work. And we all know what the things that keep us in good health are. So eating a healthy, balanced diet with your, you know, nuts and seeds and leafy veg and adequate protein. If you're doing all of those things and you're exercising, that will probably be more effective than taking collagen. That's
I mean, opinion. Not a week goes by where I'm not asked to do a job with a collagen supplement company. And I'm just like, no, I haven't seen anything that's convinced me. And I sort of say to people, by all means, take the view of a praying agnostic if you want, but definitely don't spend loads of money on something that we just don't know enough about. It's not going to do you any harm, but there's not enough to say it's going to do you much
good.
And
it is an expensive investment to make.
Oh, hundreds of pounds.
I think it's just too expensive.
Yeah, absolutely. Best products for dark circles, pigmentation and scarring. Now, we've covered some of these, but I do think dark circles is a really interesting aspect of that question, because we are so used to seeing products that say, you know, eye creams that say they'll get rid of dark circles. Talk to me about that, and with your dermatologist's hat on, tell me what your instinct is there.
So it's, in some people, dark circles are just genetic. I think that's one thing that you have to bring up, because there isn't one product or one strategy that will fix dark circles for everybody. It's partly genetic, related to your underlying skin tone. If you've got a darker skin tone, a lot of people might be very prone to dark circles, maybe related to your facial structure as well. So just the way your eye sits in your eye socket and things like that. So I don't think there's a one size fits all approach to dark circles at all. And I think it's sometimes people place a lot of false hope on a particular product and, you know,
think the topical skincare product reversing something so intrinsic to
absolutely.
It's really hard to treat dark circles. And you're right, there's lots of different causes, and it all comes down to what is your specific underlying cause. And you've mentioned a few of them. There are things like this, just the skin being thin, and underneath your skin, you've got blood vessels, and it might actually be that your thin skin is just showing the blood vessels underneath.
Yeah.
Now, thinking about skincare, how is that ever going to create enough of a boost in collagen to kind of cover up the underlying blood vessels and thicken the skin? So I think it's trying to understand what's causing it and then coming up with a realistic approach. And there is some data for some ingredients. So caffeine vasoconstricts, so can constrict blood vessels. So if the cause of your dark circles is to do with blood vessels, then it might have some benefit. Hyperpigmentation that we've already discussed. So if you've got post-inflammatory hyperpigmentation, then there's definitely treatments for that that might improve it. Vitamin C, retinoids, they all have some evidence for helping different kind of potential causes of dark circles. But I think we need to be kind of upfront and realistic here when we're saying, and just give them a realistic expectation. It's very difficult to treat these.
Concealer helps.
A colour corrector or a light reflecting concealer can go a very, very long way.
Yeah.
Another anonymous message, and I'd love some more info here, because she says, I can't use retinol at all. What is a good alternative? Now, the reason I would love to know more information is that people use the word retinol and retinoids interchangeably, right?
They do,
So when she says, I can't use retinol at all, I'm not sure if she means she can't use retinol at all or whether she's tried a variety of different retinoids.
Yeah.
So because lots of people can't use retinol but can use other retinoids, right?
Yeah.
So let's assume that she's tried multiple types, and we're guessing here. Let's assume that she's tried lots of different types of retinoid. What would be a good alternative? I mean, there's nothing quite the same.
So, I mean, Bakuchiol is often recommended as a retinol alternative. And there is a study which a lot of people have heard about, which showed that there was potentially some similarities in what they're doing. To be honest, I don't think that study is particularly convincing. But, you know, Bakuchiol is something that they could try, and it's the tolerability is pretty good. I think if they've had irritation issues with retinoids and retinol, there are definitely some peptides, which I do find generally people seem to tolerate quite well, which have been shown to have some anti-aging benefits. So things like peptides, I think, can be a useful alternative. And glycolic acid is a collagen booster. So, but if they've had issues with irritation, then perhaps that also would be something they might struggle with.
And if you're listening and you can tolerate retinoids, you can use peptides as well, by the way.
Exactly.
If you fancy using those.
Exactly. I would say that I've also seen, so Bocuccio is definitely one that's touted as the retinol alternative. There's a few other ingredients, like algae-based ingredients, that also have some evidence. And this is usually from the suppliers. But when we're talking about retinoids, for an ingredient to be like a retinoid, you want it to be basically activating the same receptors in the skin that retinoids are activating, so retinoic acid receptors. So if you're strictly wanting a retinoid-like effect, you're going to want ingredients like that. And I have seen some studies that have shown these algae and Bocuccio can activate the retinoic acid receptors in the skin. But I think I agree with you, baby. It's really all about the downstream effects of that. It's boosting collagen.
Yeah.
And there's loads of skincare ingredients that are really effective at boosting collagen. Probably not quite as good as retinoids. They're really the gold standard. But there's lots of other ingredients like vitamin C and glycolic acid, niacinamide as well, that have good collagen boosting kind of effects. So I would kind of be pushing this customer towards these.
Advice for my teenage son with very spotty skin. I don't think it's acne. There are no pustules. So this is interesting, isn't it? So full disclosure, my son, I have two sons. One of my sons is a Skin and Me subscriber. The other one is not, because he's too young. So there is an age requirement, or he was too young when he was having the problem. He's not now. So there is an age requirement. But this is a kind of key distinction, isn't it? Because lots of people talk about spots as acne and acne as spots. Mm. And there is a kind of key difference here, isn't there? Where do you think the tipping point is? When would you start saying, okay, this is acne as a problem, as a condition?
That's a good question. I would say it is all acne, personally, rather than, you know, I think anyone who's experiencing spots are experiencing a form of acne. It's just, it's on a mild, moderate.
At which point would it become, I suppose what I'm saying, at which point would it become a suitable case for treatment, I suppose, rather than nipping to the chemist and getting
It really depends on whether the person is bothered by it or not. That's what we would, as clinicians, be guided by, is how it's affecting the patient.
Yeah.
And for some people, they may have just a few spots, but it is devastating to them because of their job or the value they put on their appearance. And that is just how they perceive themselves. And we have to respect that as doctors, in my opinion. And then sometimes we see patients who have really quite severe acne, have had it for years, and are being dragged to an appointment by a partner or a parent. And I think it really depends on the person, how they are emotionally affected by what they're experiencing and what they're willing to commit to in terms of treatment. So for some people, they just can't be bothered with a skincare routine. They just don't care. They don't want to deal with it. And other people really want to be started on the strongest treatment possible. So I think it really depends on all of those things. And I don't think it's really our place to say, okay, these are the hard clinical cutoffs. I think the only hard clinical cutoff that exists within the sort of NHS framework is scarring.
Mm-hmm.
So if there is scarring, that does entitle you to getting a referral to a dermatologist.
And also having impact on kind of mental health.
Yeah, that mental health impact and scarring are the two sort of key, you know, NHS kind of cutoffs.
I mean, I love that answer. I'm so glad you said that, because I encounter this all the time. People sort of ask me about their teenage child with acne and they're almost apologetic, like they shouldn't be making a fuss because it's just part of being a teenager. And it's like, well, no, if your child is upset, socially isolated, depressed, sad, lonely, or any of those things because of their skin, then it's a problem.
Yeah.
Then you deserve to be able to see a doctor and address it.
Yeah, definitely.
And see, in this question, they're saying it doesn't sound like acne because there's no pustules. So I just want to dig into that a bit more.
Yeah,
so
please do.
There's different, in acne, then this is all acne, there's different types of lesions. And the kind of the main way of splitting those lesions is the inflammatory lesions. And they are the yellow pustules, the red kind of raised spots, sometimes the nodules that we talk about as well, the very deep inflamed lesions, and then the non-inflammatory, and that's mainly your blackheads and your whiteheads. And it sounds like in this question she's saying her son's got blackheads and whiteheads, but that's still part of acne. And we can absolutely treat that. And I think definitely what baby's saying is, if the son is bothered by these blackheads and whiteheads, then they should get treatment. Now, you can go to the chemist, or you can go to Boots or any over-the-counter place and get treatment for blackheads. Cosmetics are actually allowed legally to say they can help with blackheads, but anything more on the inflammatory side is really the realm of dermatology. Yes. and treatments. So you're not really going to be able to get massive improvements with the inflammatory lesions with kind of over-the-counter skincare. And I think it's important in those cases, because you're more likely to have scarring if you leave it, to have proper treatment initiated for the inflammatory acne.
Yeah, couldn't agree more. People can spend so much money just throwing everything at it, having picked it up off the shelf, because people are so desperate to make a change. When in fact, I think this freedom in thinking, no, this is bigger than cosmetics. This is really about medicine. Yeah. This question comes from Megs. Thank you for giving us your name, Megs. She's already a Skin and Me user. She says, I'm age 40. I'm using Skin and Me with no issues. Should I carry on as I am or move to a retinoid? So I'm assuming from that question that her current daily doser doesn't have a retinoid in it. And she's wondering, is it time perhaps to start incorporating a retinoid? What are your thoughts on that?
I think if she's in her 40s, she's looking towards anti-aging skincare, and she's been on Skin and Me for a while now and has no retinoid. I think if she's tolerating it well, her current treatment, and she's wanting to get those additional benefits, then I think she should absolutely contact the dermatology team, because what we know is the retinoids really are the gold standard for anti-aging. They're going to be the ingredients that really boost collagen production, really help with fine lines and wrinkles, and improve the overall texture of the skin. So it's a great gold standard ingredient to have, and if she's able to tolerate that, then she really should be having that. Obviously it's very difficult to comment because I'm not sure what the reason why she hasn't been given the retinoid. As we said, it's all personalized, and it might be the situation where she's got very sensitive and dry skin, and she wouldn't be a good candidate for a retinoid. But either way, I think the best thing is to get in contact with the dermatology team. They can assess how she's got on with her current treatment and see if she would be suitable for a retinoid,
because adjustments are possible at any point during your journey, right?
Exactly,
I know.
Yeah.
That I've adjusted mine with relative ease.
Exactly. Yeah.
Linda wants to know, is there any good reason to use a separate SPF and moisturiser when the moisturiser contains it?
So an SPF 50 is calculated based upon your skin's response to a standardised amount of UV with a standardised quantity of product on your skin. So they look at sort of before and after how much this product on a certain area of skin will protect you from going, will prevent you from going red. That's essentially how the SPF test is done. So we know that if you apply a certain amount of SPF, whether it's in a moisturizer or a sunscreen, it will yield an SPF 50. But if you apply less, then you won't be getting that SPF 50. And the issue with moisturizers is that you're using it as a moisturizer. So when you feel like your skin is hydrated, you will stop using it. You will stop applying more. So if you're using loads and you're using it as an SPF, good rule of thumb that people use is sort of two finger length, mm-hmm. for example. If you're using that quantity, then you're fine. But if you're not using it like a sunscreen, then you're using it just as a normal moisturizer, which may only be a very small amount, then it won't necessarily be efficacious.
Yes, I say this to people all the time. I mean, the same is true of makeup. Everything has to pass the same test as an SPF. It's just, do you want to be caked in that much foundation? You'd look ludicrous if you wore enough SPF in a foundation. Whereas in my case, I can put on gallons of moisturiser before I'm happy, and so I feel all right about it.
The other point is just sometimes when you see the moisturisers with SPF in them, they tend to not always have broad spectrum.
That's very true.
So if it's all about anti-aging and that's why you're using your sunscreen, as well as obviously protecting yourself from skin cancer, you need to have good UVA. So I wouldn't be using a moisturiser if it doesn't have at least 3 stars of the Boots rating or PA 4+. It needs to have good broad spectrum UVA protection. And I think sometimes you're just not going to get that with some of the moisturisers that I've seen out there.
Yes. And I believe the legal requirement that a dedicated sunscreen is broad spectrum does not apply to all the other products in the category.
Exactly.
So a foundation can contain an SPF that is not broad spectrum, for example. Which products are best for hyperpigmentation on black and brown skin? Presumably you see this all the time in practice.
Yeah, of course. So hyperpigmentation is really the underlying cause of the hyperpigmentation. And as we mentioned earlier, darker skin tones are more prone to having hyperpigmentation. So in terms of going back to my prevention, there's good data now that sun protection is really important for hyperpigmentation of all types in all skin tones. But in darker skin tones, it's high energy visible light. So the blue part of the spectrum is important. So if I've got a patient with hyperpigmentation with a darker skin tone, I'll recommend a sunscreen that also protects them against the blue part of the light. And usually these sunscreens tend to be things with like tinted sunscreens, which can be tricky because obviously getting the right tone to match your skin tone and your sunscreen doesn't always match perfectly. But there's some newer technologies coming out now where you're actually using chemical filters to block out the blue light. I think that's really important first kind of point. And then it depends on the underlying cause of the hyperpigmentation. So are we talking about melasma? Are we talking about post-inflammatory hyperpigmentation? For melasma, sun is really driven by sun and hormones and genetics. So it's really important to kind of understand what's the driver. But there's lots of ingredients that can treat these kind of conditions. And we've touched on them before. So things like hydroquinone, you have to be really careful with it, but it is a very good treatment.
Yeah.
It's normally given in what we call the triple combination treatment. So it's hydroquinone alongside a retinoid plus a steroid to kind of help dampen down any inflammation. That's really important because in darker skin tones, if you do have inflammation, and sometimes the ingredients we treat it with can cause inflammation, and then that can actually make the pigmentation worse because you then get post-inflammatory hyperpigmentation. Right. So you want to treat it effectively with ingredients, but you need to think about what type of ingredients and how strong these are and how tolerated they'll be. But generally the principles of treating hyperpigmentation in any skin tone is the same, but you just have to take these extra kind of considerations into account, and it's more so with the high energy visible light as well, which is a big difference.
I think the only thing I would add is, you know, obviously things like chemical peels in the right hands can be very helpful if it's sort of facial hyperpigmentation. Obviously, it depends on the underlying cause, and you want an experienced practitioner who's dealt with your skin tone before. But yeah, I think seeing someone to help kickstart that process and then maintaining it with some skincare, I think, can be a good approach.
We have three questions that I can summarize into one, because they're essentially all asking the same thing. They're saying they've either been using a retinoid or they'd like the effects of a retinoid but are currently pregnant mm-hmm. and cannot. Obviously, the use of vitamin A skincare not recommended in pregnancy. People looking for alternatives. You mentioned bakuchiol. Whether people want to try that or not. Is there anything else you would suggest? And I suppose if you become pregnant while you are using Skin and Me, can your daily dose be changed for the duration of your pregnancy?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's one of the key messages that we get across.
And breastfeeding, I should say.
Customers is if you're pregnant, breastfeeding, or even trying to conceive, you're not meant to be using a retinoid. And absolutely, we've got combinations of treatments that have ingredients that are fine in pregnancy. So the main ones that we'll be using are azelaic acid and niacinamide, which, again, thinking about how retinoids work and how these ingredients mm-hmm. work, they have similar downstream effects. So boosting collagen, improving hyperpigmentation, helping with acne as well. So they're really good multitasker ingredients.
I mean, niacinamide is everyone's friend all of the time, right?
Exactly,
so
yeah.
We can always use that.
So that's a good one. But, and maybe some of the other ingredients that we were discussing, like the bakuchiol might be an alternative.
Peptides.
So there's definitely lots of kind of alternatives out there to retinoids.
So you can take a little baby moon. If you're on Skin and Me, you can take a little baby moon and you can come back to more robust actives later on. I think that's all we have time for. I hope you're not blue in the face from that relentless stream of questions. Thank you so much for contributing them all. We've really enjoyed reading them, and I've really enjoyed putting them to our experts. Just to remind you, you can try your first month of personalised Skin and Me treatment for just $4.99. If you'd like to visit skinandme.com, you can use the code SALLYANDME, that's SALLYANDME, to get started and to access that special offer. Well, that's it for season 2 of Beyond the Bathroom. I am so grateful to you for listening every week. If you've missed any episodes, there are some brilliant women in the archives. If you subscribe to Beyond the Bathroom wherever you get your podcasts, you'll be able to find them all there, and you'll also be alerted to any future programs. In the meantime, if you enjoyed the show, please do leave a review, and I look forward to seeing you next time. Lots of love.
Insanity Group.